they called planetoids. Finding asteroids became a popular activity in the 1800s, and by the end of the century about 1,000 were known. The problem was that no one was systematically recording them. By the early 1900s, it had often become impossible to know whether an asteroid that popped into view was new, or simply one that had been noted earlier and then lost track of. By this time, too, astrophysics had moved on so much that few astronomers wanted to devote their lives to anything as mundane as rocky planetoids. Only a few astronomers, notably Gerard Kuiper, the Dutch-born astronomer for whom the Kuiper Belt of Comets is named, took any interest in the solar system at all. Thanks to his work at the McDonald Observatory in Texas, followed later by work done by others at the Minor Planet Center in Cincinnati and the Space Watch Project in Arizona, a long line of lost asteroids was gradually whittled down, until by the close of the 20th century, only one known asteroid was unaccounted for, an object called 719 Albert. Last seen in October 1911, it was finally tracked down in 2000 after being missing for 89 years. So, from the point of view of asteroid research, the 20th century was essentially just a long exercise in bookkeeping. It is really only in the last few years that astronomers have begun to count and keep an eye on the rest of the asteroid community. As of July 2001, 26,000 asteroids had been named and identified, half in just the previous 2 years. With up to 1 billion to identify, the count obviously has barely begun. In a sense, it hardly matters. Identifying an asteroid doesn't make it safe. Even if every asteroid in the solar system had a name and known orbit, no one could say what perturbations might send any of them hurtling toward us. We can't forecast rock disturbances on our own surface. Put them adrift in space, and what they might do is beyond guessing. Any asteroid out there that has our name on it is very likely to have no other. Think of the Earth's orbit as a kind of freeway on which we are the only vehicle, but which is crossed regularly by pedestrians who don't know enough to look before stepping off the curb. At least 90% of these pedestrians are quite unknown to us. We don't know where they live, what sort of hours they keep, how often they come our way. All we know is that at some point, at certain intervals, they trundle across the road down which we are cruising at 66,000 miles an hour. As Stephen Ostro of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory has put it, suppose that there was a button you could push, and you could light up all the Earth-crossing asteroids larger than about 10 meters. There would be over 100 million of these objects in the sky. In short, you would see not a couple of thousand distant twinkling stars, but millions upon millions upon millions of nearer, randomly moving objects, all of which are capable of colliding with the Earth, and all of which are moving on slightly different courses through the sky at different rates. It would be deeply unnerving. Well, be unnerved, because it is there. We just can't see it. Altogether, it is thought, though it is really only a guess based on extrapolating from cratering rates on the Moon, that some 2,000 asteroids big enough to imperil civilized existence regularly cross our orbit. But even a small asteroid the size of a house, say, could destroy a city. The number of these relative tiddlers in Earth-crossing orbits is almost certainly in the hundreds of thousands and possibly in the millions, and they are nearly impossible to track. The first one wasn't spotted until 1991, and that was after it had already gone by. Named 1991 BA, it was noticed as it sailed past us at a distance of 106,000 miles, in cosmic terms the equivalent of a bullet passing through one's sleeve without touching the arm. 2 years later, another, somewhat larger asteroid missed us by just 90,000 miles, the closest pass yet recorded. It, too, was not seen until it had passed and would have arrived without warning. According to Timothy Ferris, writing in The New Yorker, such near misses probably happen two or three times a week and go unnoticed. An object 100 yards across couldn't be picked up by any Earth-based telescope until it was within just a few days of us, and that is only if your telescope happened to be trained on it, which is unlikely because even now the number of people searching for such objects is modest. The arresting analogy that is always made is that the number of people in the world who are actively searching for asteroids is fewer than the staff of a typical McDonald's restaurant. It is actually somewhat higher now, but not much. While Jean Shoemaker was trying to get people galvanized about the potential dangers of the inner solar system, another development, wholly unrelated on the face of it, was quietly unfolding in Italy, with the work of a young geologist from the Lamont Doherty Laboratory at Columbia University. In the early 1970s, Walter Alvarez was doing fieldwork in a comely defile known as the Botaccioni Gorge, near the Umbrian hill town of Gubbio, when he grew curious about a thin band of reddish clay that divided two ancient layers of limestone, one from the Cretaceous period, the other from the Tertiary. This is a point known to geology as the KT boundary, and it marks the time, 65 million years ago, when the dinosaurs and roughly half the world's other species of animals abruptly vanished from the fossil record. It is KT rather than CT, because C had already been appropriated for Cambrian, depending on which source you credit, the K comes either from the Greek Krita or German Kreide, both conveniently mean chalk, which is also what Cretaceous means. Alvarez wondered what it was about a thin lamina of clay, barely a quarter of an inch thick, that could account for such a dramatic moment in Earth's history. At the time, the conventional wisdom about the dinosaur extinction was the same as it had been in Charles Lyell's day a century earlier, namely that the dinosaurs had died out over millions of years. But the thinness of the clay layer clearly suggested that in Umbria, if nowhere else, something rather more abrupt had happened. Unfortunately, in the 1970s, no tests existed for determining how long such a deposit might have taken to accumulate. In the normal course of things, Alvarez almost certainly would have had to leave the problem at that. But luckily, he had an impeccable connection to someone outside his discipline who could help, his father, Luis. Luis Alvarez was an eminent nuclear physicist. He had won the Nobel Prize for Physics the previous decade. He had always been mildly scornful of his son's attachment to rocks, but this problem intrigued him. It occurred to him that the answer might lie in dust from space.